Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, June 11th, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the local page with the article titled Storm Shears Lines, Harristown Damage Among Most Significant After Sunday Storms. The first sign of trouble in the Derflinger household in rural Harristown on Sunday afternoon was the television shutting off and the lights going out. Linda Derflinger and her husband Jim went outside to the 600 block of North Meridian Road to be confronted by the sight of four power poles toppled like dominoes. A powerful straight-line wind gust that accompanied squalls dumping up to 2 inches of rain in less than an hour did the damage, knocking out power to dozens of residents. The National Weather Service in Lincoln said wind gusts in the Decatur area topped 50 miles per hour, and elsewhere in central Illinois hit more than 60 miles per hour. It was just this pounding, wind and rain and everything, said Linda Derflinger, 68, who said the squall hit just after 4 p.m. Localized power outages and downed tree branches were reported across a broad swath of central Illinois, with the Harristown damage among the most significant, noted Lieutenant Jamie Belcher with the Macon County Sheriff's Office, who said the affected section of Meridian Road was expected to be closed to traffic all night Sunday. He couldn't guarantee it would be open in time for today's commute. Harristown Fire Protection Chief Steve Gambrill said his fire crews got the call at 4:10 p.m., and their main job was to secure a roughly half-mile section of road where the power poles were down. There were actually people wanting to drive over this, and some cars did drive over it, and this is big stuff, said Gambrill, meaning higher voltage lines. And some of those lines could have been live at the time. Our procedure is every downed line is a hotline. More storms south of Decatur, hitting Shelby and Christian counties, among others, were expected to dump additional heavy rain overnight Sunday, prompting the National Weather Service to warn of flash flood risks. Meteorologist Ed Scheiman said Sunday was the start of a volatile weather week, with storm risks most days interspersed with steamy humidity and temperatures up to 90 degrees. The typical summertime situation, with daily chances of storms and muggy summertime heat and humidity the whole week, he said. And from the front page, running at the speed of hope, St. Jude Decatur to Peoria Run assists Children's Hospital. From Decatur, Ann McKinney, 52, of Decatur, admits she is not a runner. But I will run for my kids, she said. And McKinney will be one of more than 60 runners who make the 92-mile trek from Decatur to Peoria for the St. Jude Decatur to Peoria Run event in August. The Decatur Relay is one of many running groups in the Midwest that will be on the road for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. It is a fantastic event, very unique and emotional, but more importantly, it's been a successful fundraiser for St. Jude, said Dave Moore, Decatur Area Coordinator for the St. Jude's Run. McKinney has been to the Peoria and Memphis, Tennessee hospitals with 3 of her 15 children. 2 children have rare blood disorders, and 1 child has sickle cell anemia. The research hospital focuses on studies and treatment of pediatric diseases. No child is denied treatment based on race, religion, or a family's ability to pay, the mission statement notes. This year marks the 4th year McKinney has joined the group of runners. I usually run 4 legs, she said. All of us run the first mile together and then the last. Runners throughout the Midwest will be meeting at about the same time on Saturday, August 4th, to cross the Bob Michael Bridge in Peoria together. Other groups will be from Monticello, St. Louis, Galesburg, and Memphis, Tennessee. The Decatur group will leave Friday evening, August 3rd, and will arrive about 4 p.m. Saturday, August 4th. The local relay will have about 30 legs that vary in distance and pace. The legs are 1.5 to 4 miles long. Moore asks each runner how many total miles they want to run and at what pace. We've had people run 30 plus miles, and we've had people run only the last mile, he said. No pace or mileage specifications are required. Runners can also jump in for extra legs or skip legs too. This is not a race and there's no pressure, Moore said, but it is a fantastic way to get in tons of miles if you want. Moore recommended runners be able to run a 13-minute mile. Anything slower would take quite a while to get there, he said. Safety is important, so the runners will have a police escort and an SUV following behind with flashing lights. Other escort vehicles will also join the group. About 10 runners will be on the road at a time, while the others will be driven to the next checkpoint. Somebody has to be running the whole time, runner Megan Holt said, so we will take turns running. Holt's plan is to run 20 of the 92 miles. I may run 5 miles, then take a couple of hours off, she said. I could be in a motorhome right next to the runners when it is not my turn to run. According to the St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital website, the St. Jude Memphis Topiaria Run was created by Jean Pratt and Michael D. McCoy to raise funds for the hospital. The original run took place from July 30th to August 2nd, 1982, with 170 runners running 465 miles. The runners began in Memphis and ended in Peoria, the home of a St. Jude's affiliated clinic. They have done it every year since, Moore said. Each runner will need to raise $1,000. They often get together for group events throughout the year. Runners can have their own individual fundraising efforts as well. So far, the Decatur Running Group has raised more than $37,000. Holt included her family to help raise money. During the Mount Zion rummage sales on May 5th, Holt and her two daughters sold lemonade and raised nearly $700. According to Holt, the events before the race are the most crucial to the run's success, because that's when all of our meetings, fundraising, practice runs take place, she said. So from now until the run is more important than anything. We are preparing, which is just as important, if not more, than the actual event. Fundraising events include selling t-shirts, painting parties, donation cans, raffle tickets, and restaurant tickets. Future events include an Applebee's pancake breakfast on July 7th in Forsyth. The restaurant will prepare the food, but the runners will serve and clear the tables for donated tips. It gets us to interact with the people there, Moore said. Holt said most customers weren't concerned about what they were buying. They just want the opportunity to give, she said. Moore has participated in the run for 5 years. He said he has found the fundraising can, excuse me, he said the fundraising can be just as much fun as the August event. When people see St. Jude's, they will dig out any change they've got, he said. They will tell you stories about people they know who have been to St. Jude's or some affiliation. Some people will be there talking 10 minutes about it. Individual and group events are listed on their Facebook page, Decatur to Peoria St. Jude Run. Runners Sherry Hood and Shannon Hackle meet with the group for practice runs and meetings. It's a fun run for us all to get together, Hackle said. The ladies were asked by other runners to join the relay. They have run other events for St. Jude's in the past, including a Chicago Marathon. A marathon is harder, Hood said. For the relay, you can pick how many miles you want and your pace. Hood and Hackle are excited about the opportunity to help others as well as participating in the run itself. But you don't sleep, Hackle said. That's the best part, to be running in the dark. To see the sun go down and the sun come up, it's pretty neat, Hood said. And this article by Donette Beckett is part of the Together Decatur series. And if you know a person or a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur, contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. And next, Tony Reed writes from Decatur about the Macon County Fair. Competitors make herding hogs look easy. Among events highlights on rainy final day, swine show. Perhaps organizers should rename it the Bacon County Fair. Things were certainly getting hog wild there Sunday afternoon when the Macon County Fair wrapped its last day with a swine show. Anyone who thinks herding cats is tough should try their hand at steering hogs into a show pen when they're hot to trot someplace else. 5-year-old Josie Stoutenborough made it look pretty easy, however, despite the pig-headedness of her beast. A few firm taps on the snout got her pig moving in the right direction under the approving eye of her grandfather, Jim Stoutenborough, owner of Stoutenborough Farms in Maroa. At 60 years of age, Granddad has been to the same number of Macon County fairs, and he said the fair's survival trick is herding visitors rather than hogs through the front gates. My boys will tell you, when they were young, our vacations were the county fairs. We didn't go nowhere else, Stoutenborough said. But the times have changed real fast. People with more to do and more time to do it in don't build calendars around hitching up the family wagon and heading into town for the fair. But Stoutenborough said events like this can still be a big draw for rural families if you have the right kind of attractions, like a one-day swine show with a cash jackpot paying out some worthwhile money prizes. Now I think they have developed a hog show here that is about as good as it has ever been, he added. This is the fair's 162nd year, and organizers said its survival hinges on corralling enough fun events to keep everyone happy. Highlights this year include a wrap-up demolition derby on Sunday, with tractor pulls and a rodeo also proving big crowd pleasers over the 6-day run of the fair. Macon County Fair Board Treasurer Teresa McWilliams estimated total attendance at more than 7,000, hampered a bit on Sunday by drenching rain squalls. Asked whether the fair will be around 150 years from now for her descendants to run, McWilliams said she certainly hopes so, but it will depend on keeping alive the volunteer spirit that runs through it. Those of us who are here are dedicated to it, said McWilliams, 44, but we're always looking for additional help. And a photograph accompanying the article shows little 5-year-old Josie Stoutenborough, who pens her hog Sunday with consummate skill. Maroa-based Stoutenborough Farms was a keen participant in the Macon County Fair swine show. Another photo with an adult woman in a pen is captioned Mackenzie Tabbert showing hogs for Nokomis-based Ogle Genetics puts a champion hog through its paces at the Macon County Fair swine show. And returning to the local and state page, Tony Reed writes from Decatur, Fire Department suspects arson. A fire Sunday morning at a house where a Decatur man suffered a fatal gunshot wound a week ago is being treated as a case of suspected arson, the Decatur Fire Department said. Fire crews were called to the home at 447 East Stewart Street at 8:54 a.m. and found the single-story building engulfed in smoke and flames. Captain Kirk Riley with the Decatur Fire Department said it took less than 30 minutes for firefighters to get the blaze under control and knocked down. On June 3rd, Bernard Norville was pronounced dead of gunshot trauma at 1:23 a.m. in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Police had been called to the house on East Stewart Street at 12:46 a.m. in response to reports of shots fired and discovered the fatally wounded 35-year-old Norville. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland said Sunday the investigation into the shooting was ongoing, but he had not received any official report on the suspicious fire. He said police would definitely be looking into that when the report comes through. Riley said a patrol officer visited the scene after police were alerted by firefighters. He said it was typical that firefighters would report such a fire, and fire crews had also been aware of the shooting death. So we called them, the police, in order to take a look at it and take a report, Riley said. The house was occupied at the time of the shooting, but Riley said no one was there at the time of the fire, which was still being investigated by fire department inspectors Sunday afternoon. And next, an article from the Illinois Bicentennial Series, which is being run in honor of the state of Illinois' bicentennial. Mormon religion grew in Nauvoo. For the Mormons, Quincy appeared to be a beacon of hope and safety during tumultuous times. Mormons began arriving in Hancock County about 1839 looking for security after having encountered hostility elsewhere, according to Thomas Gregg, a Hancock County settler who wrote about the faith in his 1880 book, History of Hancock County, Illinois. But in Quincy, they were welcomed, which contributed to the faithful choosing Hancock County as a place to settle. They established their own town, Nauvoo, north of Quincy. Gregg's book describes early Nauvoo as a picturesque site on the east side of the Mississippi River, about 10 miles north of Keokuk, Iowa. Illinois was a new home where members settled after being driven out of New York, Ohio, and Missouri. Unfortunately, the Mormon followers would eventually be driven out of Illinois, too. The founder of the religion, Vermont native Joseph Smith, was living in New York in 1820 when, at age 14, God and Jesus Christ appeared to him in the woods, according to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints website. Church members believe Smith was led in 1823 to a hill in Palmyra, New York, where he received from an angel known as Moroni gold plates engraved with the history of the people who lived in the Americas at the time of Christ, according to the Mormon website. He used those to write the Book of Mormon. Smith and a few followers made their way to Ohio, where the religion increased in numbers, but persecution continued, so they traveled to Missouri. Church members began to flee from Liberty, Missouri, after Smith and other Mormon leaders were arrested in November 1838 on charges of murder, treason, burglary, arson, larceny, and theft, according to Utopian Communities of Illinois by Randall Soland. By January 1839, Mormon apostle Brigham Young fled with several hundred followers to Quincy. Eventually, a total of 8,000 Mormons came to Quincy, where the citizens offered their sympathy and assistance by opening up their homes. Smith joined his family in Quincy, and Mormon leaders purchased several hundred acres of land in Commerce, now known as Nauvoo. By June 1840, there were nearly 3,000 people in Nauvoo. In 1844, a group of anti-Mormon dissidents formed and started a newspaper, the Nauvoo Expositor, which printed its first and only edition on June 7, 1844. It contained scandalous and derogatory allegations about the adulterous lives of Smith and other Mormon leaders, Soland wrote. Smith and the city council declared the newspaper libelous and a public nuisance, and ordered the town marshal to destroy the press. Smith's opponents accused Smith of inciting a riot and filed charges in Carthage. Nauvoo's court, which claimed jurisdiction, quickly tried and acquitted Smith. Governor Thomas Ford, however, declared the destruction of the expositor illegal and demanded that the Smith brothers, Joseph and Hiram, come to Carthage for retrial, Soland wrote. Smith was arraigned in Carthage, released on bond, and then arrested once more on a charge of treason, on the grounds that Smith had wrongly declared martial law in Nauvoo during the destruction of the presses of the expositor. A mob stormed the Carthage jail on June 27, 1844, and shot the Smith brothers to death. After the death of Joseph Smith, the church was run by the 12 Apostles and Brigham Young until 1847. Young became the second prophet and president in 1847. A couple of years after Smith's death, word spread about possible attacks heading toward Nauvoo that would lead to the arrest of the 12 Apostles and destruction of the temple. An exodus began February 4, 1846, with small groups of travelers leaving Nauvoo by walking across the frozen Mississippi River. After an arduous journey, they eventually settled in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the faith is based today. Nauvoo still draws thousands of visitors each year to see the jail, complete with its bullet-riddled door, and Joseph and Hiram Smith graves, and the temple, which was destroyed by arson in 1848, and a tornado 2 years later, and then rebuilt in 1999. And next, the big build. Work starts on the long-awaited $220 million Beltway project. Ryan Voiles writes from Decatur, "The groundbreaking ceremony for the Macon County Beltway may be over, but now forward momentum for the $220 million project is dependent on a familiar factor, the availability of federal funds. The 22-mile loop around the eastern and southern edges of Decatur has been in the works for more than two decades and was the subject of lobbying in Washington by local officials who said the roadway is critical for addressing congestion and driving economic growth. We don't give up. And we aren't going to give up. And this is what happens when all of us say we're not going to give up," said Sue Scherer, Democrat from Decatur, during the ceremony. Community leaders and elected officials celebrated the milestone, hailing the official start of a project that some critics said would never happen. The project is envisioned as a bypass around Decatur, allowing traffic to avoid congested city streets or force trucks to use rural streets. The roadway will run from Brush College Road near Interstate 72, over Lake Decatur and through Long Creek into Mount Zion, before linking to Elwyn Road. The first leg focuses on the northern portion of the project, which will take an estimated 3 months. That section, like the rest of the project, is part of the larger plan by Macon County Highway Engineer Bruce Bird to build the Beltway in smaller chunks and make an immediate impact on the community. The nice thing about this is that once we have built it and opened it up, it's a segment that we can use, Bird said. As we look at these moving forward, we're always going to be looking at, whenever we build it, we want to be able to put it into service. We do not just want to build something that's just going to sit out in a field and nothing will get to it in 20 years. Last year, local elected officials and business leaders went to Washington to seek backing from the Trump administration, which has made a commitment to making infrastructure improvements. They separately sought funding for an overpass on Brush College Road at Ferries Parkway, which eventually was lined up last week as well. The Illinois Department of Transportation on Thursday announced a $25 million federal grant for that project, now set for construction in 2020. A transportation study 4 years ago showed delays at Brush College and Ferries to be the longest in the city. Work on the connector project, including land acquisition and development, is covered by $10 million in state money given to the county in 2014 by former Governor Pat Quinn. The connector represents the start of the Beltway's first segment, 6.2 miles of four-lane road between Illinois 48, near Interstate 72, and Illinois 105, or William Street Road. The pathway would closely follow Rees Bridge Road and Prairie View Road before connecting with Illinois 105 east of the Decatur Airport. That stretch is the more costly part of the project, previously estimated at $140 million. It includes several complex segments, including a $13 million replacement of Rees Bridge Road bridges and a $19 million overpass over railroad tracks near Kitchens Road. More recently, the county's application for federal dollars puts the figure at $182 million. Byrd said the application has factored contingencies which will make sure the project is completed even if surprises were to occur during construction. As the project gets closer to completion, Byrd said, the number will likely get lower. For example, the application estimates the cost of the section that includes bridge replacement on Rees Bridge Road will cost $20 million. Yet Byrd said because his office already has a detailed engineer's estimate, they are working with the expectation it will cost $13 million. If the cash were in hand, Byrd said crews could start construction on the bridge segment by the end of the year. But as of Tuesday, Byrd said they have not received word on their application through the Infrastructure for Rebuilding America grant program through the U.S. Department of Transportation. Byrd said they requested $104 million over several years, with the hope they would receive at least a portion of that so work can go forward. Winners for the grant are expected to be announced this month. For the rest of the funds, they will continue to look for other funding sources, specifically other grants offered through the state and federal government, Byrd said. You just kind of throw everything into a big, gigantic pot for whatever you're asking, he said, and whatever you end up with, you can set your budget on and that you can get done with this portion or that portion. Community leaders have long sought to carry truck and other traffic around the city's east side. The concept became more attractive in recent years with development of the Midwest Inland Port, a transportation hub that uses the city's vast rail network and nearby highways to move goods through the region and country. City and county leaders have said the Beltway is crucial to the development of the area's economic potential. It could also open opportunities for the Decatur Airport, said Bill Clevenger, executive director of the Decatur Park District, which manages the facility on the city's east side. The airport for decades has needed access to Interstate 72, so we think that's going to be a huge step forward for the airport, Clevenger said. That connection could prove crucial as the Park District hopes to lure cargo service back to the airport, which lost UPS and its twice-daily Boeing 757 flight in 2008. The company at the time blamed the global economy for the decision. Infrastructure at the airport still includes three runways with plenty of length to accommodate UPS or another shipping company, Clevenger said. Maybe the Beltway opens up the door for us to begin those conversations with shippers again, he said. I hope we can rekindle relationships with other shippers or with UPS at some point in time. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review. It's June 11th, 2018. Please stay tuned.